From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A month-long review of the 35-year-old nuclear non-proliferation treaty began Monday in New York. There is certainly a lot of work to do, a surprising quantity. America has more than 10,000 nuclear warheads. Russia has thousands of its own, plus hundreds of tons of highly enriched but not highly secure uranium, enough to make more than 50,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. North Korea says it has nuclear weapons now, and Iran said again today it intends to move ahead with its nuclear program. 16 years after the end of the Cold War, it looks like the dawn of a new nuclear age. More countries, not fewer, with more nuclear capability. And the Bush administration pushing to invest in a whole new generation of nuclear weapons. Tonight on Point, a new and dangerous nuclear age. We begin tonight in New York with David Senger, White House correspondent for the New York Times. He's been covering the big non-proliferation gathering at the UN. I asked him to describe the attitude of the U.S. government going into the conference.
Well, the first day was yesterday, and that was when the United States went out and basically said the focus of this conference has got to be the two great violators of this, North Korea, which pulled out of the treaty, and Iran, which the United States has charged as exploiting its loopholes in order to move forward with a nuclear program that's probably still a few years away from a weapon. But, Tom, the others who are at the conference, or at least developing world and non-nuclear states were at the conference, and there are 189 countries at it, want the focus to be a bit different. They're pointing to those sections of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is now 35 years old, that commit the five known or stated nuclear states that are members of the treaty to bring their arsenals down to something approaching zero. So they're saying, well, before you worry about potential violators or new violators, how are you doing on that part? So the U.S. is trying to make the case that it is shrinking its nuclear arsenals without ever actually committing to a day when those would go away, and nobody in the Bush administration is foreseeing that day. In fact, this is an administration that wants to improve and change the nature of America's nuclear arsenal, but not make it disappear.
Remind us of those five core members, and are any of them drawing down their nuclear weapons stockpiles?
Well, the United States is certainly drawing down its, and so is Russia under the Moscow Treaty. But that's still going to leave in 2012, even if the treaty is fully complied with, will leave each side with between 1,700 and 2,200 weapons that are active and mounted on missiles, and thousands more, in the case of the United States, that will be back in storage, being either renovated or just stored away. And the U.S. doesn't want to count those as active weapons, but of course if the Iranians or the North Koreans or the Syrians had them, I bet we'd count them. The key thing to remember about the treaty is that it has an essential bargain to it. And the bargain, which seemed like a good idea 30 years ago, was that the nuclear states that have weapons, which are Russia, the United States, France, Britain, and of course China, are all committed to bringing theirs down, that the non-nuclear states are committed to remaining non-nuclear, but would get help and technology to build up commercial power reactors so they could use peaceful nuclear energy. The difficulty is that as technology has moved ahead, it has changed much faster than the treaty has. And so now many countries have gone down the line of peaceful nuclear uses of energy and used it to cloak nuclear weapons programs that come either out of the spent fuel that come out of nuclear power reactors or out of uranium enrichment programs, which is the kind that Iran is pursuing. North Korea is doing both. And the second problem that has come up is that people can leave the treaty having built up their nuclear infrastructure under its umbrella, and then suddenly they're out of the treaty and free to go on with their nuclear weapons programs. North Korea, of course, pulled out of the treaty 2 years ago.
So we have the sense that instead of non-proliferation, we've got something quite the opposite. I mean, non-nuclear states turning into nuclear states, announced or otherwise, on many fronts over these years. And the United States now, while it's taken some out of active deployment, talking about developing a whole new generation of nuclear weapons, tactical weapons that could be used on the battlefield.
Or bunker-busting weapons, which could be used to go after the secret nuclear projects of other countries, like North Korea and Iran. So you have an arms race in a different form. So clearly the treaty is in deep trouble. But nobody wants to step in, Tom, and rewrite it fully. And the reason for that is the U.S. doesn't want to reopen it for fear of all of the issues we just discussed. And Japan and France and other countries that are actively working toward bigger reprocessing facilities for their commercial nuclear programs, billions of dollars worth of programs, don't want to go along with the International Atomic Energy Agency's idea of having a moratorium on new nuclear facilities while we figure all this out, because it would interfere with their commercial programs. So everybody is sort of stuck in this round robin while we are entering a new period of nuclear instability, one that in some ways is a lot scarier than the old Russian-U.S. Cold War rivalry, because at least in that one, we knew the rules.
This conference is supposed to go on for much of the rest of the month, David. Is the United States going to try, is it likely to succeed, in turning this into a microscopic examination of North Korea and Iran, both of which have been quite vociferous just in the last few days about their own nuclear plans?
I think the U.S. is going to try, and we'll focus a lot of attention on it, but whether that will get any action is another question. This is not a conference that is intended to act against nuclear outlaws. This is a conference that is intended to review the treaty and sort of set broad objectives about where it should go. But it's playing out as we're into these confrontations. Let me just give you a brief summary of the two. North Korea declared itself a few months ago to be a nuclear state and has now stopped its one operating reactor, and we think maybe headed toward pulling out the spent fuel rods that are in it so that they could produce even more weapons. The estimate right now is that they have 6 to 8. Mm. They might be able to get 2 or 3 more. Iran has frozen its nuclear activity temporarily while it negotiates with the Europeans, but has declared recently that these negotiations are going nowhere, and today said that it would resume some limited nuclear activity, which is just an effort to step up the pressure. So the administration is going to have to be dealing with both of these short-term problems while it's dealing with the longer-term issue of the future of the treaty.
So the banner is non-proliferation, but behind that it sounds like a new kind of proliferation, and as you say, in some respects, more frightening than ever.
It is, because, you know, in the end, what made the Cold War a stable war was the knowledge that we had deterrence in place, and that if there was a strike from the Soviet Union, the Soviets knew we would counterstrike. Same thing for the Chinese, who kept a much smaller nuclear force. In this new world, nobody really thinks it's likely that somebody is going to launch a missile attack with a return address on it. You're not going to see, most likely, a missile coming out of North Korea with a picture of the great leader etched on the side.
And Santa Monica in the bullseye.
Right. You're much more concerned about a state that is desperately poor, as North Korea is, selling its nuclear technology to anybody who can bid up for it, and we know who those people might be.
And meanwhile, on the sidelines, not so far on the sidelines, India, Israel, Pakistan, it hardly sounds like non-proliferation. It should be an interesting month there in New York. David Sanger, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
David Sanger is White House correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with us from New York. We are talking tonight about a new nuclear age with proliferation abroad and a push for weapons upgrades at home. You can join the conversation. Are you surprised that 16 years after the end of the Cold War, more countries, not fewer, are reaching for nuclear bombs? That disarmament sounds antique. That North Korea and Iran are jumping in. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan from 1981 to 1985. Lawrence Korb, thanks for being with us tonight.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Korb.
Larry Korb, describe this moment for us. The banner is nonproliferation, but that's not how it feels. Do we have a kind of new age of proliferation, new and serious threats unfolding here?
Well, I think the two events that we need to talk about, one is that India and Pakistan went nuclear in the 1990s, and the United States put sanctions on them. But then when September 11th came around, we dropped those sanctions. So basically, they had not signed the treaty, but still they went nuclear, and we basically put sanctions against them. They don't have these sanctions anymore. And then the other is that you had a Pakistani physicist, scientist by the name of A.Q. Khan, who was selling this stuff around the world. And we have not put enough pressure on Pakistan to find out exactly, you know, where he has sent this stuff. So, yeah, you do have a more dangerous situation, if for nothing else, because of those two things, let alone what's going to happen, particularly with North Korea, but also with Iran.
Jack Beatty, this is some picture. All these years after the Cold War, I think many Americans imagined, once that was behind us, we would indeed see some radical disarmament. Maybe the nuclear weapons threat put back in the bottle, the famous genie back in the bottle. It's not there.
It's not there. And look what's happened with on our own side. In our strategic doctrine, we've abandoned deterrence and containment for preemption. Meanwhile, in our nuclear posture, we've abandoned the foundation of deterrence, which was mutually assured destruction, by backing out of the ABM treaty. It's almost as if we're saying, well, Iran, Korea, North Korea, they'll get weapons, but we'll have a missile system to counter them. And with our preemption policy, if they get too close, we can go in and just strike their missiles and with our shield protect ourselves. Boy, that's an awfully risky strategy. It seems to me diplomacy might be a far better way to deal with such problems. But you almost think that in the unconscious of the Bush administration, that's the world picture.
And somehow it feels as though nuclear weapons are moving toward, despite all the opposition, moving toward becoming part of a nation's closet of weapons, just one more piece in the arsenal. Lawrence Korb, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about a new nuclear age, nuclear weapons proliferation abroad, and pushes for upgrading at home. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Did you ever imagine that 16 years after the end of the Cold War, we would see more, not less, nuclear weapons proliferation? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new nuclear age, the surprising global evolution toward more nukes all over the place, it sometimes seems. You can join the conversation tonight. Why are North Korea and allegedly Iran pushing so hard for nuclear arms, pushing so hard to get the bomb? Did you imagine that all these years after the end of the Cold War, we would see this nuclear weapons situation right around the planet? You can join us tonight, 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty's with us tonight. So is Lawrence Korb, Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan, 81 to 85, now Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Last week in Rhode Island, former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara spoke at the Watson Institute on International Studies at Brown University. He called for more empathy toward countries that are pushing for nuclear weapons, an effort to understand why.
If I were the North Koreans, if I were the Iranians, I would want nuclear weapons. The Iranians are facing the Israelis, in a sense. The North Koreans are facing the South Koreans. It's understandable. North Korea, if I understand it correctly, has said, we will, in effect, move toward dismantlement if you provide us a security guarantee, a guarantee against aggression. We settled the Cuban Missile Crisis by providing Khrushchev a guarantee we would not commit aggression against Cuba. Why not? We never had any intention of doing so anyhow. We never had any intention of committing aggression against North Korea. Why in God's name won't we sit down and talk to them and lay it out in a convincing form?
Former U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara speaking last week at Brown University. We're joined now from New York by Henry Sokolsky. He's Executive Director of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center in Washington, editor with Patrick Clausen of Checking Iran's Nuclear Ambitions. From 1989 to 93, he was Deputy for Nonproliferation Policy in the Office of the Secretary of Defense under Paul Wolfowitz. Henry Sokolsky, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
You've written and spoken up for a tough policy with Iran and North Korea. There's former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara talking about empathy with emerging nuclear powers. What do you expect to come out of this month-long meeting in New York? What's the right posture for the U.S. in this period when weapons appear to be proliferating?
Well, I guess I don't share your assessment that things are proliferating yet. I think the reason this topic is timely is because we're at a tipping point. I mean, the countries you've listed have had nuclear weapons upwards to 10 years.
North Korea?
North Korea, yes, sir. They were assessed to have nuclear weapons certainly in the mid-90s by the CIA. So the point isn't that things are spinning out of control yet, and I think Kofi Annan got it right. Mm. It's what will happen from here on out. And I think your other guests have highlighted the concerns about what might happen. The speech by Kofi Annan, which I recommend, it was really quite good.
Mm. On Monday.
It got zero attention. I do not know why. Maybe it's the way he delivers his speeches. They're kind of deadpan. But the speech itself was quite good.
Tell us about it.
Well, I'll tell you what was really unique about it. Normally, the way people talk about the NPT, or the Non-Proliferation Treaty, is this bargain between those that have nuclear weapons getting rid of them in exchange for countries that don't have them not getting them.
That wasn't the original bargain?
Hmm. No, the original bargain, as the Irish representative spoke on the first day, made clear, came from Frank Aiken, foreign minister of the Republic of Ireland, in 1958. It took 10 years to negotiate the NPT, and the original bargain was simply this. Those that didn't have wouldn't try to get, in exchange for those that had them, not spreading them. And the push for the treaty came not from countries that had nuclear weapons, but from countries that didn't. They didn't want their neighbors to get them. Now, that got transmuted, to be sure, over the 10-year period into a debate about whether or not those that didn't have should give up the right to have nuclear weapons in exchange for peaceful nuclear energy guarantees and all this other stuff. But the original bargain was quite simple and sensible and elegant. We need to get back to that as much as we can. And it seems to me that what Kofi Annan focused on, he said, is the big point was point number 4 in his list of things to do. It was the biggest part of the speech. And he said, besides not letting breaches pile up against the rules, he said the regime will not survive if everyone reads this agreement as one that compels them to get the means to make nuclear fuel, bringing them within days of having nuclear weapons themselves. He said that if enough countries do that, the rules will just break down and everyone will want to have these capabilities such that you'll have a world in the Middle East and the Far East and other places full of countries that are within days of getting a nuclear arsenal. He said that is a prescription for just the worst kinds of fears being realized. Everything from war to things being stolen and not being known and, God forbid, a nuclear terrorist act. Nuclear 1914, where you don't know who has what and you make miscalculations and a war breaks out, except people have nuclear ammunition and many cities get destroyed. I mean, it is not the world anybody wants.
Kofi Annan was
very focused on the need to compel people to understand that the treaty cannot be read as one which encourages countries to get to that point.
Lawrence Korb, clearly there are a number of ways of reading this treaty. We've heard a lot about a different interpretation of the fundamental bargain here.
Right.
Larry Korb, how do you interpret what's the kind of operational bargain that people are assuming here, and do you, what are your expectations of this meeting in New York? Can we get the genie further into the bottle?
Well, I think it's important to point out that whatever the original intention may have been in the review conferences that have come up every 5 years, it has become more and more clear about this bargain. I think if you read the treaty, it's in the treaty in Article 6. And that is the expectation, I think, among a lot of countries. And where this administration has undermined the case is, as Jack pointed out earlier, by going to develop new nuclear weapons. I mean, even Republican members of Congress like David Hobson and Kurt Weldon, very conservatives, are sort of outraged by what the United States is trying to do. Now, we do have the problem that I think that Bob McNamara talked about. If you put a country on the axis of evil, and as Jack pointed out before, you adopt a strategy of preventive war, not preemption, which preventive war says I have the right to take you out if you have the capability to cause me problems, you are going to encourage people to develop these weapons. One of the reasons the president gave for going into to Iraq was, well, we better get in there before they develop nuclear weapons. Well, if I'm country X or Y and I'm on some list, this is going to get me to move in that direction. I think you can do things at this at this conference. I mean, one of the things the United States can do is they can say that the administration is going to submit the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty to the Senate for ratification, because this is what we promised back at the last review conference. They could talk about the fact that we will allow inspections under the Fissile Materiel Control Treaty, because that's what we're trying to do, is to prevent these materials from getting into the wrong hands. So I think they're right to talk about the problem with Iran and North Korea, but you can't just stop there if you want to create a climate that makes the world less dangerous for nuclear weapons.
Henry Sokolsky, how about it? In terms of the climate that's been created, how do you see the last 10 years of U.S. policy, the last 4 years under George Bush? Has it helped, or has it made it?
I would say, look, under the last 30 years, there has been an inattention to what Kofi Annan and Mr. El-Baradei and even Mr. Bush do agree about and focused on, and is that the reading of these rules has been sort of through the lens of the nuclear industry. Anything goes. If we can claim it's peaceful and it goes to friends, we'll let it happen. What's happened, however, is North Korea and Iran have turned out not to be friends and have followed the same kind of behavior and gotten very close to having bombs, and in the case of North Korea, clearly have gotten them. Now, the desire to focus on a clause that talks about good faith efforts to reduce the nuclear arms race is reasonable. We should rely less on these weapons. There are efforts underway to actually destroy half of the stockpile by 2012. And certainly if we get down to the figures that Mr. Sanger talked about, it will be an 80% reduction of what we had deployed, you know, just 15 years ago. We're also in favor of the fissile material cutoff. But the problem isn't just what the United States is doing to reduce its reliance. And yes, it needs to follow through and not say, hey, these things are important in other areas. I think the problem is where Kofi Annan placed it and where the bulk of his speech is focused in the near term. He talked about the things that you're talking about as long-term concerns. Mm. The near-term concerns, he said, has to be on cauterizing this notion that you can get anything you want under the mantle of peaceful nuclear energy under what's called Article 4 of the treaty, and as long as you claim it's peaceful, you can get very close to coming to the point where you have bombs. He seemed most concerned about getting progress on some restraints there. Now, I think Mr. Sanger has rightly pointed out in some of his articles that, gee, it doesn't look real good. Countries cynically are wasting, I think, a lot of money on costly projects that will lose money, but there's a lot of inertia to separate plutonium at Rokkasho, for example, in Japan, and countries are hedging their bets that maybe things will change, and so they don't want to go to a moratorium for fear it will be expanded and extended. What Kofi Annan said, what Mr. El-Baradei said, is, no, we're going to have to tackle this as if it really mattered, and even if it hurts a little, and we can't do things that certainly are cost-ineffective and dangerous. I suspect that at some point, you got to hope that this conference says roughly on these points, Mr. Bush, Mr. El-Baradei, and Kofi Annan are right, and Iran and North Korea on this are wrong. And also, they all point out that countries that violate, withdraw, should not be able to do so with impunity if they go on to make weapons. And that currently is the model that North Korea has established, and that has to somehow be corrected, preferably in a country-neutral way. But you've got to start talking about this with the specific cases. So it's not that crazy to focus on Iran and North Korea. I think you have to get beyond just beating up on those countries so that the rules get read in a more general way for everybody. But it's a good place to begin.
Jack Beatty,
now,
join us here.
One other comment.
Oh, yes, please.
Other comment. I don't think people recognize it, but there's a big news event today. The Iranians were made the vice president of the review conference. So
hello.
The prospects of getting agreement with Brazil and Iran and the chair and in the vice chairmanship of the conference, well, it may not be a slam dunk that you're going to get consensus now.
Jack Peter, I want to turn to you here. I've got to say that the tenor that we see out there, personally, is not what I expected to see in 2005, I don't think, if I was looking forward from the late 80s. You know, AQ Khan having spread know-how and more than that all over the place, North Korea with Iran allegedly on its way. We'll hear later in this hour from San Nunn about his concerns of how close terrorists may be to getting hold of nuclear materials, even explosives. This is a different picture, whatever you think of the original bargain, than an awful lot of people imagined at this point in history.
Yeah, it's as if the balance of terror in the Cold War really did do that. It balanced out the terrors. But now everything is loose. And what bothers me is the priorities that are being assigned to things by this administration. You know, I mean, Larry Korb, his website points this out. While they're cutting the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program that essentially pays former states of the former Soviet Union to dismantle their nuclear warheads, they're cutting that 7% in this budget, and their budget overall for that this year is about $919 million. Meanwhile, we're spending $100 billion a year for Iraq and $10 billion a year for missile defense. Now, wait a minute. The stuff in the Soviet Union, in former Soviet Union, is alive right now. It is weaponizable now. It could leak to terrorists and rogue states now. Whereas the missile defense is something way in the future, if it ever works at all, and Iraq has nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. It's just an allocation of priorities that seems to me completely out of whack with the reality you're describing, which is we're turning a new page here, and people are getting weapons who shouldn't have them.
Larry Korb, what are the most important steps you'd point to try and corral this activity?
Well, I think that Henry is right and Kofi Annan is right that we do have an immediate problem, and we need to make it clear to countries like Iran and North Korea that if you withdraw from the treaty or you game the treaty, like I think Iran has done by developing peaceful uses so they can slide over into weapons, mm-hmm. that there's going to be a price from the international community. After all, Iran wants to get into the World Trade Organization, for example, and I think you need to make it clear that the international community will not look fondly upon it. And I think the United States and the rest of the world need to make it clear it's not just regimes, it's the weapons. I mean, part of our problem seems to be we're saying, okay, North Korea and Iran, you can't have them because we don't like your regime. Brazil talked about it, and there was very little reaction from the United States when they talked about whether they would, you know, move in that direction. I think that we also have to make that clear, that it's the weapons, it's not just the regime. And then I think we have to move on a number of fronts. I think Jack is quite right in terms of the Fissile Material Control Treaty. I mean, when John Bolton announced this summer that we would not allow inspections, even the British were aghast. They said, well, how are you going to have a treaty if you don't, you know, allow inspections in the United States? So I think you have to do it comprehensively. You just can't say, well, we have a problem with, you know, Iran and North Korea, so that's what we're going to focus on. That certainly is important. But if you don't do it all, I don't think you're going to create the climate in the international community that can deal with it. And we can't deal with it mm-hmm. by ourselves, particularly with proliferation.
So where do you think we're headed here? Sometimes it has the feeling that we're headed toward nuclear weapons being almost presumed as part of the arsenal of, you know, any country worth its salt that imagines it might ever have to stand up and fight someone significant.
Well, I think you have to do it on a case-by-case basis. I mean, I don't see why we don't sit down with the North Koreans. I think it's great that we have the six-party talks, but there's no reason why we can't talk to them ourselves. And the same way with Iran, for the longest time, the Europeans were trying to get us involved in the talks, and we simply would not do it. I mean, I think, you know, the late Yitzhak Rabin had a wonderful saying. He says, you know, you don't have to negotiate with your friends. You got to negotiate with your enemies. I don't see why we can't get involved in talking to those countries, and I think that certainly would help if we made that a priority. I think one of the problems we have with North Korea, when they announced that they had the weapons in 2002, we basically sort of put it on the back burner. So we're too busy with Iraq now. We can't worry about it. No, we needed to be get involved right at that particular point.
Henry Sikorski, where do you think we'll be 10 years from now? Headed toward more nations with nukes or having drawn an effective line in the sand?
I like effective lines in the sand because that captures an ambiguity, which I'm afraid we're going to slip toward, and that is this. You're not going to know if countries have nuclear weapons. It's going to be like North Korea. It'll take 18 years for someone finally in the foreign ministry to say, well, we've got them. And then people will dispute whether they're bragging or lying. I think what you're going to find, if you do not move towards some sensible moratorium and some clarity on what can be, it's called safeguarded or not, you're going to be moving towards a world where many countries will come within months or weeks or even days of having nuclear weapons, and the uncertainties of international relations will be much greater than they are now.
Henry Sikorski, Lawrence Korb, Jack Biddy, please stand by. We're talking about the dawn of a new nuclear age. Where are we headed here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the dawn of a new nuclear age, nuclear weapons proliferation abroad, and talk of upgrades at home, the surprising global evolution toward more nukes. You can join the conversation tonight. Where are we headed here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Washington by Lawrence Korb, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, from New York by Henry Sikorski, Executive Director of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center in New York. Right now, Vivek is calling us from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Vivek, you're on the air.
Hi, I just had a comment to make. I agree. I definitely feel that we are in a very much more dangerous nuclear age than 50 years back. But I feel, as United States, we cannot take that moral stand Iran cannot have a nuclear weapons program or North Korea cannot have a nuclear weapons program because of two reasons. One, just last year we had a preemptive attack on Iraq under the pretext that they have weapons, and I think this has painted a very wrong picture of America all around the world. And second, we have a huge stockpile of nuclear weapons. We are the only country who has used nuclear weapons in a war situation. I think, given this background, we really have no moral right to demand of countries like Iran or North Korea not to pursue a nuclear program, whether it is for peaceful purposes or a surreptitious way of trying to build a weapon.
Yeah, Vivek, we've got it, and thank you for your call. Henry Sikorski, how about it? This goes back to the bargain. You say the bargain was never there in terms of disarmament for not arming up.
Not the way you framed it. Not the way you framed it.
Understood.
It was incomplete the way you framed it.
Let me ask you, on this moral front, if the United States is not seen as ambitiously moving more aggressively toward disarmament, does it inevitably have the effect that we're hearing in Vivek's comment? Well, if the U.S. isn't drawing down, what moral authority does it have?
I think he's right. If people come to believe that the United States, despite cutting its stockpile in half and coming down 80% over the last 15 years, is not relying less on these nuclear weapons for its military operations, then people will say, well, we've got to hedge our bets and pony up. But I don't think that's an accurate reading of what's going on, number one. And number two, I do think that, you know, the United States got these weapons and a desperate race to make sure Hitler didn't get them first, and then to compensate for its conventional weakness against what it thought was a much stronger country conventionally, the Soviet Union. I think we need and can speak to the need to rely less on these things precisely because it's not to our advantage to have a world trying to match our capabilities. But here's the rub. Unless the world moves away from getting these things, it will be very hard for us to give them up either. So, you know, this is not one of these Manichaean black and white things. This is a transition that has to happen.
Larry Korb, how do you see the U.S. nuclear weapons profile right now, both what it has active, what it has in storage, and what President Bush has pushed for. And I wish you'd remind us of exactly where that stands. There was a lot of talk about bunker busters, nukes that could vaporize deeply buried targets, maybe nuclear facilities abroad. What is the impact of the U.S. nuclear profile on global perception of the need or advisability of having nuclear weapons themselves?
Well, I think two things. I mean, Henry's right. We have cut them down quite substantially since the end of the Cold War, but we still have way more than we need. And this treaty we have with Russia, the so-called Moscow mm-hmm. Treaty, which says by 2012 we'll be down somewhere between 1,700 and 2,200, that has a loophole in it because after 2012 it goes away. And the other is that we're going to keep a lot of weapons in storage. I think if we would move right away down to 1,000 and get rid of those weapons in storage, that would send the right signal.
Would that penalize U.S. defense?
No, not at all. I mean, 1,000 strategic nuclear weapons are more than enough, really, for deterrence. And I think by this idea of developing two new nuclear weapons, or sort of a smaller nuclear weapon as well as a bunker buster, makes no sense to me militarily, because if you drop these things, even if you say they're smaller, I mean, it's still going to break the threshold between nuclear and non-nuclear, and it also increases the probability that you might use them. I think that's what people are saying. I mean, when Don Rumsfeld goes up and says, "Well, you know, there are 7,000 targets that we need these bunker busters for," it does sort of break the line between nuclear and non-nuclear. And, you know, the Congress, to its credit, has stopped this, and they asked mm-hmm. for a study to be done by an affiliate of the National Academy of Sciences, and they basically came out and said, you can't limit the collateral damage with these things. The idea that somehow if you drop the bunker buster underground, it will destroy the hardened target and there won't be, casualties above ground. They said that's simply not true. It could be in the hundreds of thousands. And I think that's the problem that a lot of countries are having with us. While we're saying one thing, in many cases we're doing another.
And Congress hasn't gone there, but the impulse clearly is not dead. Jay's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Both your experts are actually giving you very conventional wisdom regarding the NPT and nuclear weapons. The NPT is a treaty that is bleeding because of the violations, and the reason, and we're putting band-aids in, which are being recommended. The bottom line is, I would like to direct you to a better way of looking at this geostrategically, and that is Professor Mearsheimer's view from Chicago.
John Mearsheimer, University of Chicago.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, which is that if the number of nuclear powers actually increase, it actually creates more geostrategic stability, and all that happens basically is that the emphasis shifts to negotiations rather than military power play. And
Jay, our time is short. Let us pick it up right there. I think we've got it. Henry Sikorski, what about this notion of a global balance of terror? You suggested that we're headed there, even if people don't announce it. Is there a security in that comparable to the mutually assured destruction?
I've never understood this French argument, which Mr. Mearsheimer's picked up, which it used to justify getting nuclear weapons itself, that by spreading nuclear weapons and getting people, if you will, frightened of one another and creating more uncertainties, that everything becomes clearer and more stable. This is not the direction sane people go. And in fact, this is the funny comment about mutual assured destruction being mad.
Yeah.
This cannot be the way serious people promote security. Mr. Mearsheimer is a sort of an academic, and he predicted all sorts of things that have not come true, and it's not surprising. I don't think that is the prevailing opinion amongst most folks. And the argument depends on every uncertainty going in the right way. You know, some of the things that could happen if everyone has handguns is a lot of homicides. And I think there's just too much wishful thinking there.
But of course, it's the NRA view of the world, and that's when it comes to handguns, and maybe there's a counterpart on the global stage. Jack Beattie,
I've never heard anybody promote the NRA view as a national policy.
Certainly on handguns, not on nukes. Jack, what's the sound that you're hearing here of the genie slipping back into the bottle or spreading out?
I'm afraid spreading out. And, you know, there was a dialogue last week, a question Hillary Clinton with talking to the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and she got him to admit that basically North Korea is capable of miniaturizing a nuclear warhead, putting it on a missile, and eventually landing, having a missile that could hit the west coast of the United States. Well, and she rightly pointed out that was unacceptable to the Clinton administration. They were going to go to war. They were going to bomb the reactors to prevent that. Bush and company seem ready to live with that. That was not acceptable to Bill Clinton. It was not acceptable in the consensus of the time. And that's where I fear that this fantasy of missile defense is in their idea. They don't need negotiations. They have got preemption to take care of it. And if they take a wild shot, why, we've got our nuclear weapons shield up there. Mm. That's a fantasy.
Well, in time, we will see exactly who's prepared to live with what. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight. Henry Sokolsky at the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center in Washington. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Lawrence Korb, Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan, now Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Great to be with you, Tom, Henry, and Jack.
In a moment, former Senator Sam Nunn takes his campaign against loose nukes to Hollywood. This is On Point. Former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn has spent years trying to raise public awareness of the threat posed by loose nuclear weapons or materials getting into the hands of terrorists. His latest project, though, is unlike anything he's done before. Nunn's nonpartisan group, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, has funded a new made-for-TV movie entitled Last Best Chance. The 45-minute film's fictional plot centers around an al-Qaeda attempt to acquire nuclear weapons. It is scheduled to be released later this month. Earlier today, I spoke with Senator Nunn. I asked him for a synopsis of his new film.
The story really relates to what we call a fact-based scenario. It is actually fiction, but it's based on facts, with a lot of experts coming together to make sure that it's based on facts. And it relates to a scenario with, in this case, al-Qaeda, but it could be other terrorist organizations trying to get nuclear weapons. And they're doing it by trying to get nuclear materials from a couple of locations around the world, and they're also trying to get a tactical nuclear weapon, a battlefield, a small nuclear weapon. And this shows the struggle of trying to basically figure out what they're doing and how they're doing it, and then it shows the great difficulty that the leaders not only of this country but of the world would face if terrorist organizations get nuclear materials or if they get a weapon. And it also demonstrates pretty clearly that it is a lot easier to protect the materials or the weapons at the source. And once they get away from the source, it's a needle in a haystack.
I don't think it gives too much away to say that they do get hold of nuclear material and then the race is on to stop nuclear terrorism.
That's right. One thing that the public does not understand in large part, but should understand, and policymakers particularly should be acutely aware of this, is that there's weapon-grade material all over the world. It's not simply just in the United States and just in Russia and a few other countries. There are over 40 countries in the world that have sufficient highly enriched uranium to basically produce one or more nuclear weapons.
Sam Nunn, you've been known as a kind of a button-down right-coast guy. This is a left-coast endeavor. Are you going Hollywood? Is this a one-time-only Sam Nunn in Hollywood appearance? What drove you to help get a movie made?
Believe me, even if we win the Academy Award with this one, which we will not, I do not believe, but even if we did, this would be my last movie. It's a tough job, and I don't envy the people who have to come up with the plots, but we particularly were challenged to draw a balance between entertainment and education, because obviously our purpose is for people to understand the real dangers. This is not a partisan issue. It's an issue that goes beyond any political party or any administration. It goes beyond one country. We have to really have a partnership around the globe, and that's what this demonstrates. As I see it, Tom, we're in a race between cooperation and catastrophe, and this movie makes that pretty clear.
And how serious is the threat of nuclear terrorism, of terrorists setting off a nuclear explosion in a population center somewhere in the world of the United States? As we speak today, how serious is that threat?
Well, certainly there are more likely threats. One more likely threat would be dirty bomb, that is, radiological material that does not reach the stage of an explosion. Another probably more likely threat would be chemical explosion. There are chemicals everywhere, and even a biological would be more likely. But the consequences of a nuclear attack on one of our cities by only one bomb, a crude bomb, not delivered by a missile, but delivered by a truck, the consequences would be catastrophic, not only for the human beings involved, but also for the confidence of the world. So it is certainly, the odds are not nearly as much against it as we need to make them.
You've got Ted Turner and Warren Buffett who have ponied up money for this effort. You've got former television news anchor Tom Brokaw who's chipping in. These are some high-profile guys contributing their money and time. But is the public as aware as these big figures of the depth and seriousness of the threat?
No, the public is not aware of it, and it goes way back. Senator Lugar and I have been working on this program together since the early 1990s. Many other people have been working on it, but there's not large public awareness, nor is there broad support from the leaders of our nations. This requires presidential leadership on a consistent basis. President Bush and President Putin have both, at one time or the other, said all the right things, but down in the bureaucracy, it doesn't get to be a front burner issue, and it has to be. So we have a long way to go in public education, and this is indeed part of it. I made a talk on this subject about a year ago, and one of the people in the audience, George Russell, stood up and made a pledge on the spot to support our organization with substantial financial support. And as you said, Warren Buffett understands this very well, and he talked to 20,000 people on Saturday about it. And from that one talk, we now have over 5,000 requests for the DVD when it's available, which will be in early May. So we think it can spread, but people really have to be acquainted with the facts, and they have to know it's not simply a movie. It really could happen.
And, of course, you've got former U.S. Senator Fred Thompson playing the president in this film. He who has migrated toward Hollywood, as you until now have not. Senator Dunn, have you found a cable channel to run this movie yet?
No, we have not. We still have hopes that someone will pick it up and run it on television. If they don't, we're going to do our best to distribute it. We have a website called lastbestchance.org, and people are communicating already with us on that. We're hopeful to get it on television because that's the best way to communicate. But in this day and time, I think we can make a distribution that would have a real impact even if we don't get it on television.
Sam Dunn, did you ever imagine during the Cold War that this many years after the end of the Cold War, there would be this kind of nuclear threat facing the world in such dire terms as you see it?
I hate to say it, but I've been aware of this for a long, long time. I've been engaged in this a long time. You don't want to hear all the stories I've got about why I arrived at that conclusion, but I came to the conclusion many years ago that the chances of a terrorist group or a third country launching a nuclear weapon was much more than a deliberate attack by either of the superpowers, because that would be suicide. And also came to the conclusion a long time ago that we have a lot more danger from a group that doesn't have a return address going into the nuclear business and actually causing an explosion than we do from a country, even a third world country, that has a return address and would be destroyed if they ever launched such an attack. But I don't want to diminish the North Korean threat. That's the most serious nuclear threat we have now. I think it's probably parallel and about equal to the threat between India and Pakistan, but they're getting along better these days. And, of course, the Iranian threat is not to be diminished either. But, nevertheless, I think the terrorist threat is the greatest and the most likely to occur.
Sam Nunn, now Hollywood producer, warning of nuclear terror catastrophe. Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Former Senator Sam Nunn is co-chair of the Nuclear Threat Initiative. For more on the film Last Best Chance, visit our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.